From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, those open lines. Here's what's happening. Mohammed Yusuf Abdulaziz, that naturalized American turned Islamic radical who killed four Marines on Thursday, apparently was heavily armed, wore an ammo vest, and was bent on waging war against America, according to authorities who spoke a day after the horrific attack at two military facilities in Chattanooga, Tennessee. The 24-year-old Abdulaziz, a Kuwaiti-born person, he was a Chattanooga resident, but he was born in Kuwait, was killed by police. He was using an AK-47 to gun down the unarmed Marines after crashing into a gate at the Navy Operations Support Center. Just an unbelievable story, a story of hate. 34 commercial flights reported lasers pointed at them as they flew over New Jersey. That's the latest in a growing number of such dangerous incidences plaguing U.S. skies. There's no indication that the incidents detailed the FAA led to any notable injuries or accidents. We've been lucky, but this is very dangerous for aircraft, endangering crews, passengers alike. Forever in Our Hearts was the banner headline in 1996 in a special additional tribute at the Montessorville Area High School newspaper after TWA Flight 800 crashed, killing 16 students and five chaperones from that school. A memorial committee consisting mostly of students from that era trying to make sure that with the aid of social media now that those victims are not forgotten. Friday, on the 19th anniversary of the tragedy that took 230 lives, the committee is urging random acts of kindness as a way to remember all those who lost their lives. One person who investigated was Jim Sanders. His book is The Downing of TWA Flight 800. Can't believe it's been this long, Jim. Unbelievable.
It's been an amazing journey. I would say, you know, Bill Burns, who was my agent way back in 1997 mm-hmm. for that book, he stuck with me over the years. And I'm telling you to 100% certainty, we will be providing the evidence that will make America understand to 100% certainty what happened.
You know, Jim, you and I have talked on this program for years, both about TWA Flight 800, other flights, and, of course, the missing MH370. With 800, why don't they just come out? I mean, your speculation is that it was shot down accidentally by a Navy missile that was trying to take down another plane that was attempting to crash into TWA Flight 800. Why don't they just tell us what you've discovered?
Yeah, well, I wouldn't call that speculation anymore. I just can't go into the details yet. But why they don't, I can't tell you that. They're obviously, you know, people who have immense power just don't think like the rest of us. It seems so simple to us, but to do something that the rest of us would believe would be logical, which is to tell the public as soon as possible what went wrong, that in a presidential election year and with over $1 trillion in military contracts on the line simply wasn't something that was willing to be done by the power structure back then.
All right, and Jim, thank you for your work on this incredible story. And I have a feeling we're going to hear from you again on it, huh?
Yeah, I have a real good feeling about that.
Okay, thank you. Jim Sanders, just a dedicated researcher and author. Authorities were scouring the area around a remote mountainous campground in Idaho for any sign of a 2-year-old boy who disappeared from the site nearly 1 week ago. The parents of the 2-year-old simply told police that their son wandered away and simply disappeared. Now, on Monday, we've got a complete program with David Pilates, who's going to be talking about people who are disappearing from campsites and forests. And we're going to add this story to the mix. A committee of scientists has advised the government to half the current recommended daily intake of sugar. Nutritional experts say no more than 5% of the daily calories should come from added sugar, about 7 teaspoons. Most people consume at least twice this limit. The more time you spend on your phone, the more likely you are to be suffering depression, according to a study. According to researchers, depression can be detected from your smartphone sensor data by tracking the number of minutes you use the phone and your daily geographical locations. The team from Northwestern University found that the average daily usage for depressed individuals was about 68 minutes. Our resident psychiatrist, Dr. Peter Bregan, with us. Peter, how in the heck could they tie in smartphone use with depression?
Well, it wasn't very hard. They had volunteers. They did depression scales before and after. And they counted the amount of time on the phone as well as other things. I was able to get a hold of this study, which sometimes I can't. You know, they don't always put them out right away.
Right.
And in this case, they weren't counting what kind of phone activity it was. It could have been game playing. Could have been phone calls, could have been surfing. They're guessing, and I think they're right, that it was probably game playing and surfing, because we know that people who are lonely, people who are sad, people who are going through losses tend to get on the computer more than others. They tend to do social media more than others. And we've got a few studies now. That's why I don't think we need to even think critically of this. We have a few studies showing that people also go on the phones and play games. And younger people may go on and talk more, but in general, it's a withdrawal behavior. It's the same study, George, found out that these folks are not going out as much. They're not moving around as much. They're sleeping more irregularly. So I think this is just a manifestation of what people do when they're sad and when they're lonely. And it's, if you find yourself and you don't love the computer like I love writing on it and write on it hours a day, but if you're doing it to escape, if you're doing social media to escape, or on your phone surfing, then it's time to think about the fact that what you really need is to find a way to re-engage with people.
All right, Peter.
Life.
It's great for you to look at that with that kind of perspective. A man who has spent almost 25 years searching for the elusive Loch Ness Monster has concluded that the creature is, in fact, a very large catfish. Stephen Feltham says that he was not claiming to have solved the mystery that has baffled scientists and enthusiasts for more than 70 years. But he says, looking at the evidence, speaking to eyewitnesses, the most likely solution is that it's a Wells catfish. Wells catfish can grow up to 13 feet long, weigh up to 880 pounds, and survive for decades. They are not native to the United Kingdom, having been introduced to the loch in the 19th century for sport fishing. So there you have it. What else is unusual these days? Let's check in with Peter Davenport from the National UFO Reporting Center. Hello, Peter.
Well, good evening, George. I have to preface tonight by saying I don't know what's going on, but I've received some really, really interesting and unsettling reports over the last 7 days. You may recall last Friday I talked about an incident that had occurred in Glenpool, Oklahoma. A gentleman saw he called it a tube. He said it was the size of a 747, no wings on it, just streaking across the sky in Glenpool, Oklahoma. Well, we have a similar report that just came in from a gentleman in Germantown, Maryland. He was driving from Hyattsville to Germantown, Maryland, just north of Washington, D.C., and he saw something similar, except he saw two of those tubes, metal tubes. He estimated they were close enough to him he could estimate their size. He estimates that they were the size of railroad tank cars or even bigger. He estimated they could hold 300 people seated in an airline fashion. Very, very interesting report, now posted to our website for people's enjoyment. Just this morning, I received another interesting report from a woman in, I believe it's pronounced Lemoyne, Maine, state of Maine. Lemoyne is just north of Bar Harbor. It's just up the coast from where the Bushes have their compound, the George Bushes.
Up there in Kitty Buntport.
Yeah. I've been there many a time, actually. She reports that on the 8th of July, which I believe was a Thursday, 9 days ago, she was getting ready for bed. She looked out her window, and her whole backyard was filled with round, luminous balls the size of baseballs, George. And they were gliding, suddenly darting, changing direction. She was absolutely enthralled by what she was looking at, she reports. Well, they suddenly just disappeared as if they winked out. 2 minutes later, they were back. 2 minutes after that, they were back again. She said she's never seen anything like it. I talked to her this morning, very, very sane and sober type person, a typical Downeaster, as I would call them, and a very good report that's posted to our website. 2 nights ago, Yakima Firing Center, not too far from where I'm sitting in eastern Washington, a very, very large triangular object floated over Yakima Firing Center, very well-known military facility here in Washington State. And the gentleman who submitted the report said that the 9th Infantry Division was training at the training center at the time. He said this object dwarfed everything that was at the center. If anybody was witness to that object, we would love to get confirming reports about that alleged incident. Three sightings from today. You probably know where the Spirit of St. Louis Airport is, out west of Chesterfield, Missouri.
Know it well.
Very dramatic sighting there by a gentleman whom I can only describe as an aviation professional with years or decades of experience. He was on the east side of the airport, and he looked to the west, and he saw an object he estimates 1/10 the diameter of the sun. So a very prominent object out in the western sky. He drove away from it. He continued to watch it. He has no idea what it was. It just suddenly disappeared. And very briefly, two reports from tonight. First one from Jeffersonville, Indiana. A gentleman reports that they saw a very large triangular craft with white lights in the corners glide right over his community. The power failed on 4 separate occasions, George, he reports. And that was at 22:15 Eastern. At exactly the same time, a very similar sighting from Louisville, Kentucky. We're awaiting the written report from the woman who called that one in. So a lot's going on. I have no idea what these things are, of course, but I would encourage anybody who has sightings like this to sit down, write it down, and submit it to the National UFO Reporting Center.
Peter's website, ufocenter.com. So how many times has somebody told you a very strange story, a bizarre story? In a moment, Jay Hansen joins us. We're going to be talking about some of the strangest stories you've ever heard next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast Friday nights. I just love them. Jay Hansen has been an avid student of the paranormal since he was a little boy, 7 years old. And over those years, he has researched virtually all aspects of the paranormal, the supernatural. His website linked up at coasttocoastam.com, foilhatninja.com. Containing all kinds of strange and bizarre paranormal topics. And he also does it with a little tongue-in-cheek sense of humor. Jay, it's good to have you on the program. How are you?
I'm doing great, George. Thanks for having me.
So, 7 years old, what happened to you then to kind of jumpstart your paranormal career?
Okay, well, actually, 3 things happened to me when I was in first grade that either shaped or warped me, depending on how you look at it. I mean, shaped and warped, they're almost synonyms.
They are.
But the first one was, I saw a documentary about Bigfoot, which I had never heard of Bigfoot before, but it also contained the always controversial Patterson-Gimlin film.
Yes.
Which, still debated to this day, but to a 7-year-old, that looked real enough to me.
Sure did.
And then not too long after that, I was shopping with my grandmother at a discount store, and I came across this book in a discount bin. It was a book of allegedly true ghost stories. And that just fascinated me because, you know, at 7, there's not supposed to be such a thing as ghost.
Now, was this written for adults or for little kids?
No, this was a regular-sized paperback for adults.
Wow.
And I somehow managed to convince my grandmother, who was the daughter of a Methodist minister, who, of course, never encouraged any sort of belief in the paranormal in her children or grandchildren. Somehow I got her to buy me that book, which I never read because I was too scared to read it. But the third thing was, I was out to dinner with my family, and my father happened to mention, I was living in Dallas at the time,
uh-huh.
And my father happened to mention this UFO that had supposedly crashed north of Dallas back in the 1800s. You may be familiar with that. It was the
that's crash. The one where they apparently buried the occupant. And somebody apparently is made off with the bones or something like that.
Yes.
Wasn't that case? Yeah. Great story. Jim Mars investigated that too. So those three episodes really got you going. Now, I'm going to assume for a moment, Jay, that you didn't keep up at 7 years old into the paranormal. You probably picked it up a little later on, or did you?
Well, actually, when I was growing up, I spent more with cryptids. When other kids were reading Charlotte's Web and The Mouse and the Motorcycle, I was reading books about the Loch Ness Monster and the Yeti and Bigfoot.
Yeah, me too.
But you know, that was just an interest. That's what started all of this, and I've just never lost the interest in it.
Now, you started to get into, and we're going to talk about some incredible cases, very strange, bizarre cases of possession in demons and areas like that. Would you consider yourself a researcher, someone who compiles the stories? What would you categorize yourself as?
You know, honestly, I have come to think of myself as kind of a paranormal historian, which is never really what I set out to do when I set up this website, but it seems like what I've become, and I'm comfortable with that. I've got no problem being a historian.
Let me ask you about what is called the talking mongoose. I've heard strange stories before. This one may take the cake. Tell me about this.
Oh, yeah, this is Jeff the Talking Mongoose. This is my favorite story of all time as far as paranormal goes. It all started in the fall of 1931. This was on the Isle of Man.
Mm-hmm.
And on a remote farm called Doirlish Cashin. And the people who lived on the farm were James and Margaret Irving and their 13-year-old daughter, Voirie. And that's a regional name. And one day they just saw this very unusual animal. It looked like a small weasel, about 9 to 12 inches long, with a yellow fur and a large bushy tail. And they'd never seen anything quite like that. They weren't too alarmed, but probably the most unusual thing about it was this weasel was very near their chicken coop, and the chickens didn't seem to care at all, which is very unusual behavior for chickens.
Right.
In the presence of a weasel.
A mongoose loves chickens.
Yes. So anyway, they just saw that thing. They thought that was unusual, and before too long, a couple of days later, they saw it a few times in their house, and more than seeing it, they heard it. They lived in the farmhouse was all completely made of stone, but inside, because you know stone walls are pretty depressing, they had put up scaffolding with wood panels over it, and that gave the creature plenty of room to run around behind the wood paneling so they could hear it back there hissing and barking and just running around.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the first strange thing, for reasons that I have absolutely no explanation for. James Irving apparently decided to start trying to teach this thing animal noises. And so he would make the noises of various animals, and supposedly this thing would make noises back to him, and within a few days all he had to do was say the name of the animal. And this thing would repeat it. Well, they were calling him Jack at the time, I guess I should.
All right, so like if he made a sound of a roaring lion, this mongoose would do the same thing?
Right.
That's weird. Wow. Okay, go ahead.
Well, so that was the beginning of him actually making sounds. Before too long, He also started reciting nursery rhymes and singing hymns that he had obviously heard from Voiry. And
well, hold on, Jay. We're going to hit the break, but we'll come back and talk more about this. That's just one of the bizarre stories you're about to hear. 150 people to sign up, and we're at 16,000 members for ParanormalDate.com. So go ahead and do that. If you would, it's free to sign up, ParanormalDate.com. And also, it's time for you to start sending us your success dating stories, because we're going to work on a different program for you. Just send it to george@coasttocoastam.com, and I hope that's all working out for you. But 150 short. Love to reach that number of 16,000 by the end of this weekend. And we're going to be back with more with Jay Hansen as we talk about very strange and paranormal stories on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast as we talk about some very strange and unusual stories. Jay Hansen with us. So, Jay, let's pick up the story of Jeff the Mongoose. So, apparently, they're starting to teach this thing how to talk. It's doing nursery rhymes. You got to tell me more about this.
Well, apparently it just it picked up the nursery rhymes and started singing the hymns that it was just hearing from Voiry, the Irving's 13-year-old daughter. And not too long after that, he just started talking spontaneously and became conversational with the family, and they began talking to him, getting to know him. And at first it was kind of threatening. He was not, sometimes he would be congenial, but other times he would be much more menacing, as in, like, at one point he told them that he could kill them all if he wanted to.
Oh, that's nice.
And, well, he quickly pointed out that, well, I don't really want to, but still, the threat is there. I mean, it's implied. You don't just say that to someone.
Typical mongoose.
Right, right. And at one point, he became so threatening toward Voiry that that her parents moved her bed into their bedroom. And while they were doing that, they heard Jeff say, "I'll get to her wherever you put her."
Wow. Now, was the mongoose living in the house or outside?
At this point, the mongoose seems to have been almost consistently behind the wood paneling inside the house.
Behind the wood paneling. Okay.
So they... they heard him very often. They saw him very infrequently. But that night, as they were moving, as they moved Voiry's bed into the parents' bedroom, James Irving barricaded the door with a large dresser. And at some point during the night, they saw the door above the dresser start to bow inward as if an incredible force was pushing in on it. And then they heard Jeff say, "I'm coming in," at which point a container of ointment flew across the room and smashed on the bed frame.
Jeez.
And that seems to have been the end of the exploits for that night. I guess he expended all his energy doing that. But by this time, the Irvings had really pretty much had enough of that, and James Irving told him, you know, if you keep up this threatening tone, this threatening attitude, we'll just leave. After which, Jeff actually got quite a bit nicer.
Huh. So how did it end?
Well, he seems to have actually had a connection to the Irving family. It was recorded that he strangled over 20 rabbits and left them on their doorstep for, you know, as presents for them for dinner.
God.
And at some point around this time, someone notified Harry Price in England, who was like the number one paranormal researcher in England at the time. And he, of course, just completely dismissed the idea of a talking mongoose as being absolutely ridiculous until he saw an article in, I think it was the Manchester Daily Dispatch, of a reporter who had gone out there to do a story about Jeff. And his conclusion was that there was absolutely no reason that an honest family like the Irvings would make up such an insane story as this, and also that Jeff was reported to have a very screechy, shrill, and grating voice, and he didn't believe that any human, not even a 13-year-old girl, could fake a voice like that. And so Harry Price decided, well, if there is a talking mongoose out there, then I guess I need to know about it. And he was a little too busy, so he sent his man, a guy named Captain Dennis, out to the farm to investigate. And so Captain Dennis went out there, and he had some interesting thoughts. His first thought was, of course, that this is a fraud, that this is a 13-year-old girl who's just pulling all of this off. But he actually heard Jeff speak a few times when Voyeur was nowhere around. And at one point, he insisted that the Irvings' locker in her bedroom upstairs, just to make sure that she was not the one responsible for this. And apparently that made Jeff mad, because he said, well, now I'm gonna show you what I can do. And they started hearing rapping noises coming from all over the house. And at one point, Captain Dennis went upstairs to make sure the Voyeur was still locked in her room. And when he was coming back down the stairs, a pitcher that was sitting on a table on the landing flew past him and smashed at his feet. So all of this at this point, of course, is sounding a lot like a poltergeist.
It sure did. Now, was this story,
mm-hmm.
I mean, this is an honest-to-goodness story. I mean, we don't know whether the mongoose really talked or not, but, I mean, this was a story that people thought was really happening, wasn't it?
Oh, yes, it was. By some reports, more than 20 people actually saw Jeff, because people would come to the farm to have a, you know, just to experience this. And so I don't know how many people heard him, but at least 20 people were said to have seen him. And he also liked to go out and travel around. And there were people who got a little annoyed with Jeff about some of the things he would do when he got out and traveled around the countryside. For instance, he liked to take the bus, apparently, to the nearby town of Peel. And
so a mongoose goes up, he jumps in the bus. He doesn't have any money, does he?
No, not that we know of, but no. In fact, the only reason for any of this seems to be that he could, so that he could report back to James Irving the gossip that James said he wasn't interested in hearing about the people who worked at the bus stations. But there was one bus driver who told a friend of the Irvings that he absolutely had no choice but to believe that Jeff was real, because James Irving once described to him in perfect detail the inside of his house, even though he'd never been there. And he allegedly got that information from Jeff. And one of the bus drivers was so annoyed by all of this, he decided to go way overboard, in my opinion, and put an electrified plate on the bottom of the bus to try to electrocute Jeff the next time he stowed away.
Oh, my God. I was thinking, is it possible that somebody was a ventriloquist and he was playing games with people?
Well, that has been brought up, but no one can really figure out who the ventriloquist would have been, other than possibly Voyeur. But there are people who say they heard Jeff talk when Voyeur was not around. And in fact, Captain Dennis actually said at one point he had a conversation with Jeff, and he could clearly see Voyeur out the window feeding the chickens more than 100 feet away.
And then what finally happened to the mongoose? He just faded away or died? What happened to him?
Well, you know, all of this started in the fall of 1931. By 1937, everyone just seems to have lost interest. It sounds like, I think maybe that they'd written or done all that they could write or do. And there was a family friend of the Irvings who said that Jeff continued talking until 1940 and continued to be seen until 1944.
What a bizarre story.
Yeah, well, and James Irving died in 1945. Now, at some point in here, Voyeur moved away. Now, whether the Jeff ceasing to speak corresponded with Voyeur moving away, I have not been able to determine. I don't have any official dates on those.
But the theory, though, Jay, is that a poltergeist was talking through the mongoose, I assume, right?
Well, that's the main theory. Most people regard Jeff to just be an extremely unusual poltergeist case. And there are certainly a lot of reasons, a lot of similarities to think that that's true.
Did anybody ever get hurt being around him?
Mrs. Irving actually once cut her finger on his teeth. They were allowed to, Jeff told them they could stick their hand back behind a gap in the partition and feel his And I guess she cut her finger on his teeth, but that's the only instance I know of Jeff ever harming anyone.
Well, maybe he wasn't even trying to bite her. Maybe she just sliced her finger on his
teeth. Oh, no, actually, he allegedly showed concern for her after that he never meant for that to happen.
Yeah, I guess he would go crazy. That's strange. Now, there are other cases you've looked at, too. Of course, the old Bell Witch case. Remember that one?
Yes, I remember the Bell Witch.
How did you investigate it, or what did you do with this one?
Well, I've studied up on it, and people who know about Jeff and the Bell Witch say, even though there are so many differences between the two, the Bell Witch case is probably the closest to Jeff as any other case that anyone is aware of. One reason being that an animal was actually involved in the Bell Witch case. A lot of stories leave that out, but there was a story that that John Bell actually saw an animal that looked like what he described as being a dog with a rabbit's head out in his cornfields one day, and that he took a couple of shots at it, and then the animal just vanished. And it was only after that that all the things with the poltergeist activity started around the Bell home.
Yeah, that was a truly strange story that, of course, they turned into a movie, low-budget movie, but a very profitable movie indeed, wasn't it?
I have not seen the movie. I was aware of it, but I have not seen it.
It's scary. It's got its scary moments of it. But did you spend much time investigating this case?
Well, yes, I did, because I found it. Well, another thing I found interesting is that the witch loved to talk to people, just like Jeff.
I think I'd rather talk to a mongoose than a witch like that.
Well, you know, that was my summation of things as well. Is like, if Jeff wanted to come stay with me for a while, I wouldn't have too much of a problem with that. But the Bell Witch can keep her distance.
Well, but I'd go to sleep with one eye with a mongoose running around the house, huh?
Well, apparently his favorite foods were sausage, bananas, and chocolate. So it's not like he'd take a bite out of you or anything.
These stories, Jay, that come to you, these strange stories that you investigate, stumble across, do people send them in to you? How do you find them?
You know, I've just stumbled across most of them over the years. There are some of them. In fact, I could not tell you where I heard about Jeff the Talking Mongoose. I have absolutely no idea where I first heard about that.
And that's a first for me, too. And I'm sure everybody listening to this program tonight, they've not heard of Jeff the Talking Mongoose. Bizarre. But the fact that it may be backed up with a poltergeist experience, that makes sense. What else have you looked at?
Well, I've looked at possession a lot. I've always been fascinated by the idea of possession, because that's just, you know, the idea that you could be taken over by another entity is, well, interesting, but also frightening.
And most people get possessed, do they not, when they are either, you know, they've had too much to drink, they're on medication, or, you know, they let their guard down and they get possessed that way. Have you heard that?
Right, and I've also heard from actually different cultures that there has to be something within you that resonates with what is possessing you, that, you know, that if you're a wonderful, pure, and good person, you cannot be possessed by an evil entity because there's nothing there for it to grab hold of.
What is the case of Lawrence Venom? Tell me about that story.
Okay, Lawrence Venom was a young lady who lived in Watseka, Illinois, which is about 70 miles south of Chicago. And let's see, let me get my years straight here. I think it was in 1877.
Okay, well, it's going way back.
It is going way back. She started having seizures. And while she was in these seizures, she was 13 years old at the time, and while she was in these seizures, she would sometimes mumble incoherently about angels. And then other times, apparently other personalities would speak through her, one of which was an elderly woman who was very crabby and called herself Katrina Hogan. And another one was a young man who, according to some sources, said he had committed suicide, and he claimed his name was Willie Canning. And, of course, she would come out of these fits, and she would have no memory of this. But, of course, her parents were very concerned because that's,
sure,
that's not good. So at some point, they contacted Dr. Stevens, who was, in addition to being a doctor, was also very involved in the spiritualist movement, which was popular at the time. And he agreed to talk to Lorency, and he came to their home, and he hypnotized her. And while under hypnosis, she told him that she had been possessed by multiple evil spirits, and that she could see spirits there in the room with her, and she began to name some of them. And one of the spirits she named was that of a girl named Mary Roth. And it just so happened that Mary Roth's father was there.
That's strange. Okay.
Yeah, there actually is an explanation for why that weird weird coincidence would happen. But she said that she would allow Mary Roth to speak through her. And so Lorency started speaking as Mary, and Mary's father confirmed that everything this little girl said about her daughter was absolutely true.
You know, and this is happening in an era where there was no radio, no television. I would guess word of mouth got these episodes and these stories all over the place.
Well, I would imagine so. Some of this was written up in local newspapers, but of course, you know, the circulation for those was
small.
Yes, I mean, if you've ever tried to find old records of newspapers, you know they don't even exist.
I mean, now you'd have Twitter and it would be everywhere.
Yes, of course.
So did the little girl, she ever get hurt, or whatever happened to her?
Okay, what happened? Well, the reason that Mary Roth's father was even there in the first place is that his daughter Mary had been very sick in her lifetime as well. Mary had died when she was 18, when Lorency was just a year old, before her family had even moved to Watsika. Mary suffered from epileptic seizures and depression that went along with that. She actually tried to kill herself at one point, and she finally died when she was 18.
Oh, geez.
And it's not exactly clear what happened to her, but it sounds to me like she had one of her seizures, and she passed out and hit her head on something on the way down because they found her in a pool of blood with a large wound on her head.
You don't think she was internally haunted, do you?
You know, that's interesting because after her suicide attempt, they put bandages over her eyes. She was in a coma for a while. They put bandages over her eyes to keep her from scratching her eyes out. And when she came to, she was able to see, despite the fact that the bandages were covering her eyes. And in fact, in one case that was witnessed by a newspaper editor and a minister, she allegedly was able to read a letter that was in the newspaper editor's coat pocket inside an envelope. And I have no idea what to make of that.
How many of these cases have you come across? Lots of them?
Oh, no, these are pretty few and far between.
The creme de la creme of the old haunted stories, huh?
Yeah, yes, I consider myself lucky to have even stumbled upon them.
Well, we're going to come back in a second here, Jay. We'll talk about some other cases of Katrina Hogan, who were they, and Willie Canning, and what did they have to do with all of this. And we'll take some phone calls where I want you to share some of your possessed stories. Those people who know people who were possessed, check in with us next.